Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome back to Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione. I wanted to, John and I wanted to start today's program with a little bit of reminiscence about Rush Limbaugh, who is someone who has been influential in both of our lives and outlooks. And certainly, Vec, since we've had this podcast, he's somebody who I think anybody who's in this medium looks to with respect and admiration. You know, we do this for 1 hour once a week, and he did this for 3 hours, 5 days a week. And it's if you ever try to do it once, it gives you new appreciation for his genius and what he has done for the format, but also for conservative thought. And so I just wanted to share a couple of stories about my limited interactions with him. But really, I was introduced to Rush in the summer of 1992. I was selling, and I don't know if you know this, Vec, but I was selling Cedarwood Roof Preservative door-to-door in the summer of 1992. It was the summer after my freshman year in college, and that was the sort of the best summer job I could get. And it was turned out to not be a great experience, except for the fact that we spent a couple of hours every day from about noon to two putting together our brochures and everything in the headquarters. And for whatever reason, a lot of the other folks there were college students, and some of the fraternity guys from the University of Kansas decided that we should all start listening to the Rush Limbaugh show during this period of time when we were all just, you know, folding our flyers and everything that we were going to take out to the houses. And so I listened to him that entire summer, and that was really my first introduction. And I was just remember being impressed and enthusiastic, and first became aware that he was the one really who was setting the terms of the debate for the conservative movement. I think he took over from Bill Buckley and folks in the magazine world as the person who was doing that. And then in I think it would have been the fall of 1993 or so. I might be off by a year. But some college friends of mine at Yale decided to take the train into New York City and get tickets to the Rush Limbaugh TV show. I don't know if you remember, Vec, do you remember the Rush Limbaugh TV show?
I do recall.
So we took the train in, and we were in the studio audience, and it was so exciting and fun. I think that might have been the first time I'd ever been in the live studio audience of a TV show. But I remember that vividly, and we had such fun. And, you know, he came up and talked to all, it was, I don't remember, maybe 50 or 100 people at most in the audience. And he came up and just, you know, talked to everybody, before the show. And it was great to see him and hear him in person and watch the show. And what I walked away with, you know, he wasn't quite the same on television as he was on the radio, but he wasn't afraid to experiment. But he also wasn't afraid to stop when it proved not to be his strong suit. And, you know, he rededicated himself to the radio, and he would make guest appearances on TV on other people's shows, but I don't think he ever had his own show on television again. But I was glad I had opportunity to see that. And then go ahead.
I don't think it was unsuccessful either. It just wasn't he wanted to be the best, you know, he just did not have the impact on TV he had on radio, but it wasn't like he couldn't have done that show forever. It's just,
he'd
be the best, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. And I called into his radio show then in December 2000, after finally it was clear that George W. Bush was going to be the president and Al Gore, I think, conceded eventually. But Bush was picking his cabinet, and all these names were coming out. And Rush was complaining about the lack of conservative picks in the cabinet. And I can't remember if it was that day or the day before John Ashcroft had been picked as the incoming attorney general. And so I decided I was going to call up Rush and say, hey, look, you're for, you know, John Ashcroft is a good, strong conservative guy. And you, you know, you need to recognize that that President Bush is picking some strong conservatives here. And, you know, we had a good back and forth, and, you know, he had his, you know, his views and so forth. And I'd been on hold forever, and but I was so excited when I finally got through and got a chance to talk to him on the radio. Probably still the largest audience I've ever had was the, you know, 5 minutes talking to Rush about John Ashcroft on the air. But in any event, when he put out the recording of the show for later listening, my segment was cut out, and I was so disappointed. And I remember, and then I realized, you know, that this was really an early version of podcasting, what he was doing with recording his show and then putting out a you know, shorter packaged version of it. And he knew what he was doing. The point he was trying to do was to pressure President Bush to make more conservative picks, right? It didn't do him any good to celebrate the few conservative picks who Bush had made for the cabinet. He wanted him to make more. So it was, you know, he viewed it as his job not to necessarily be even-handed in his treatment of the people Bush had picked, but to try to put on pressure for more conservative picks. And my segment wasn't advancing that, you know, that goal. So it was left out. And then I had an experience when I went back to my high school reunion, and I think this was the 15th reunion, but I, you know, wouldn't swear to it. It might have been the 10th. It's been long ago now, Vec, that long enough ago that those things blend together. But in any event, I had a long conversation with a woman who had been a cheerleader in our class and I had gone on one date with in high school, and we were just catching up a little bit, and she wanted to talk all about Rush Limbaugh and conservative ideas and everything. And she was a stay-at-home mom, and she listened to Rush Limbaugh every day. And I have
and
to
you
tell
only
you,
went back, on one date with her.
Yeah, one date. And and she had very well-formed conservative ideas on a whole range of public policy topics. And I asked her about it. I was like, I don't remember you being in political in high school at all. And she said, oh yeah, this is all stuff I've learned from Rush Limbaugh. And I just thought, wow, if he can teach the masses as well as she was articulating the conservative ideas that she had picked up from the radio show, that in itself is impressive. And I don't mean to treat her as you know, in some way, when I say the masses, I don't mean that, you know, she's less capable than average or something like that. But I think that he has the ability to teach people all across the spectrum. And I would point to somebody like my dad, who he's a doctor, he's a smart guy, but he's not a political guy. He certainly never studied political science. He's never been involved in working on a campaign or anything like that.
I would call the people who are otherwise unpolitical. That's
there you go.
Speech.
Yeah. But you know, my dad listened to Rush and more often than I did. And we had some fantastic political conversations as a result of the political education that he got from Rush Limbaugh. And he gave my kids Rush Revere to read when they were little, and you know, Rush introduced my kids to some of the first conservative ideas and paved the way for people like Ben Shapiro. And I mean that Rush paved the way for Ben Shapiro to have the career he has on the radio and podcasting. But I also mean that he has set up people like Ben Shapiro to be my kids' favorite podcast to listen to. And they, you know, they listen to Ben Shapiro all the time. And that's through, they found him on their own. That's through nothing that I did. But you know, just through YouTube or what have you, they stumbled upon Shapiro and love him. So, you know, Vec, you and I were talking like, who's going to replace Rush? And the answer is, well, nobody. You know, there are the people out there, the Mark Levins, the Ben Shapiros and so forth. But no single person can replace Rush Limbaugh.
Well, the thing I remember is that he had moved to New York, and I heard him in New York when I was still in law school. But I didn't, you know, I had things after I had a job and I was clerking. I couldn't listen to the radio in the middle of the day. So but what I do recall is 94 when the Gingrich had the contract for America, all these Rush rooms sprung up in New York and D.C. and the beginning of the sort of cigar craze. They had gone away for a while, but these cigar bars were open, and they would these rush rooms. And you'd go to these places that were like, I don't know, something like out of a 40s movie, but you'd have cigar lounges with
Macanudo. Steaks,
martinis. Oh, yeah, yeah. And then there'd be Rush rooms, and everyone would be listening to Rush all through that And they were around for a while. They became like a phenomenon after 93, I think. But that's what I remember. And I cannot say I listened to them that much, especially lately.
Well, you have a day job like me, so yes, it makes it more difficult.
The fact is, I was saying, I listen to the Sunday recaps oftentimes, but he had a very, the quality of his voice and the quality of his personality is why I don't think, and the sheer talent on loan from God is why I don't think anyone will replace him. And it is going to be a blow to the conservative movement because he does reach people other folks could not reach. And he did translate a lot of books people aren't going to read, a lot of ideas people aren't going to have time to read. He would translate them and use examples from real life that would make them come to life. So I do think that his later, you know, lately he has not been as influential. I think he's been more following sort of the audience than leading it. But the fact of the matter is that he had this huge audience forever, and he did make conservatives where – there would not have been any. So it's a big blow. It's a big loss. And I do agree that since we started this radio program, you really get a full flavor of how hard it is to create that much content on your own, pretty much the way he did. He didn't have that many guests or anything. He didn't have he had a great staff, obviously, but he was doing the work for 30 years.
He was. Well, we're sorry to lose his formerly nicotine-stained fingers, but glad that we had him while we did, and we'll be back with more on Administrative Static right after this.
Welcome back, folks. This is John Vecchione for Administrative Static, and I'm here with Mark. And we're in early days of the Biden administration still. And one of the interesting things when any administration comes in for folks like us who litigate in the federal courts against the federal government is what position the Justice Department's going to take. Now, the Justice Department bills itself as the world's largest law firm, and it really is sort of the, along with the State Department, the crown jewel of the administrative agencies. There's state, and there's justice, and they've been there, you know, since the first Congress, pretty much. And they take their jobs very seriously at justice. But with any administration, you have views that are approved and views that are not approved, and you have your priorities. And one of the interesting things to follow is cases that are active, that have already been filed. And are they defended and do they move forward or are they dropped? I think the worst thing that can happen is that they are poorly prosecuted. I think that in some administrations, certain cases, it's almost like they're colluding to lose. I haven't seen any of those yet in the Biden administration, but I found some interesting cases that they've dropped and one that they're continuing that I find interesting and amusing. So, Mark, one of the things, the big issues going on right now under the civil rights laws are how colleges and areas of higher education deal with race and admissions. This is an extreme hot button. And the hottest of the buttons are, of course, the top two educational establishments in the country. Just ask them, Harvard and Yale. And so these two have both been in litigation, one private litigation by Harvard, but the government did put in, I think, a laboring oar there, that Asian Americans have to jump a lot more hurdles than people of other races or backgrounds in order to get into those institutions. So the Justice Department had just brought a case against Yale saying that its treatment of Asian Americans was racially discriminatory. And they have ways of showing this. They show that SATs have to be higher, and that all the qualifications for Asian Americans are much tougher than they are for whites or African Americans or Native Americans or what have you. And so the Justice Department had brought this case against Yale, and they dropped it. The Biden administration dropped it. And this is a big deal because I think the previous Justice Department cases were in order to give a lesson to all of the institutions of higher learning in our country about what they were doing. Because in the Harvard case, their defense was, and I'm not making this up, this is something they said, was that the Asian Americans had disproportionately bad personalities.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what they said.
That's how they
explained that. That's why the interview scores were lower, is what they is what they said.
Right, and I don't know. I guess I think Andrew Yang would differ with that. He certainly seems to have plenty of personality. I was stunned by the whole thing that they said that, and I also. It reminds me a little bit of the views of Harvard and Yale at the turn of the last century, which was that certain people are just unclubbable.
Yes, that's right.
So it does have that ring to it. But anyway,
in the 1950s, I believe the term that Yale used was raises tropical fish when they wanted to indicate that someone was of the unclubbable. Was that what you said?
Yeah,
of the unclubbable variety. Yeah.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. There's a great, great book, Joining the Club, I think is the name of the book by, Daniel Oren, about the admission of Jews at Yale who were terribly discriminated against up through the 1950s, 60s. I'm not sure exactly when it ended. But Jewish students now comprise, or at least did in the 90s when I was there, about a third of the student body. So I think the discrimination of yesteryear is gone, but it's been replaced with this discrimination against Asian Americans.
And that was also the height of the SATs and the ACT and all those other standardized tests came in order to break up the old boys network. It's very interesting how progressivism works, because those tests were brought in so that the legacy folks wouldn't all have their kids go because they knew the guy on the staff, the president or something. So that is why we have standardized tests. They were meant to get the top minds from all over the country, regardless of what their backgrounds is. And now they were doing away with them. And the folks who bring these cases think it's because the higher education is racially discriminating in order for diversity or for whatever reason.
But so why does DOJ want to drop the case?
That's right. So Biden is signaling that he is not going to be on board with race-neutral application of the civil rights laws. I think that's what justice is signaling, or at least it's not a priority. But he could be signaling that despite the fact that he's the first president in a while not to go to a Yale or a Harvard or a Georgetown, that he is that part of the Democratic coalition that is made up of Yale, which is certainly an important part of it, doesn't want the old alma mater sued. But I'm going to bring up another case that they've dropped. So I think they're signaling there on civil rights. And then the other one justice has dropped is that California passed a net neutrality law. And I don't want to get in the weeds of the technology because, as Mark knows, I can't. But really, it has to do with how who gets to decide how fast you get internet information. So the question is, the people who say that we're all going to die if there isn't net neutrality laws, and they do say that. I mean, you should have been here in D.C.
when poor Ajit
Pai was being. I'm telling the audience, I know you were here, but the poor guy is trying to make scientific and economic decisions, and they're all saying, "Oh, if the internet is run this way, we're all going to die." I was like, "You got to be kidding me! I was around when there's no internet. We didn't die."
Ajit has been pretty well vindicated on that one.
There's no question. I think he won that fight. But in California, of course, it was passing a law so that the internet companies could not discriminate on how you get your internet sources, basically. And it's not clear to me that they were discriminating, but this law was California's answer to the fact that the federal government wasn't going to do it. And we have for the Trump administration wanted there to be one law across the country, because that's the other thing. They didn't want the states to all have different laws. That creates a huge mess for the internet, which is, of course, it's supposed to be everywhere. So the Biden administration, I think, is signaling two things. What is the Justice Department signaling? Justice Department is signaling that they like what California is doing, and if the internet providers have to just go along with California's law, they may do it for everybody. They may do it for Vermont or Arkansas or whoever, because California just runs so much of that. So this case is being dropped. And the other thing is, look, California gives a huge proportion of its votes to Joe Biden, and they don't want to be in a fight with California. So I think they're signaling both California has clout in Democratic administration, and that they don't mind legislation that fiddles with the internet, and that they're willing to pick sides. And so I think that's an interesting one, because that is not as clearly ideological as, for instance, civil rights is. But it is interesting that they dropped that suit. The other one they are pursuing, they are dropping, which I'm going to finish with two amusing ones, is that Stephanie Winston Wolkoff, who wrote the book Melania and Me, and violated her NDA and told stories out of school about Melania for a buck. Justice is dropping that suit. They are not pursuing it. What that signals, I will leave it to the listener to figure out. But so Melania's aide gets a free pass, and they're dropping that case. But you know who doesn't? You know who's the government apparently is going to go after, no matter who's in charge? Omarosa Mangold Newman, known, I think, by everybody as Omarosa, has a suit against her by Justice, because when she left, she was fired by General Kelly when he was chief of staff. And you're supposed to fill out these forms about that have to do with disclosures under the Ethics Act, having to do with money. And she refuses to fill them out. And it says in the complaint, she made no attempt to file any termination report before September 2019, more than a year and a half after it was due and after this litigation was commenced, DOJ lawyers wrote. Then following that submission, in which only half the required fields were even filled out, and nothing bureaucrats hate more than fields that aren't filled out, defendant made no effort for over a year to correct her submission, despite being promptly advised of its deficiencies. She remains out of compliance with the Ethics in Government Act. And so she's there before Judge Leon here in D.C. He's a senior he's taken senior status here in D.C. And they want to impose a civil penalty of $61,585. Now, they are continuing with that, and I think they're signaling there that they're going to take the Ethics Act seriously, and they're not going to drop it just because she's Omarosa and she's claimed that the suit was against her because Trump was mad at her. But I find it very interesting that Omarosa is on the hook for $61,000. But, Mark, I wonder if she's not going to get more money out of the publicity of this suit than $61,000. I think that it could be to her benefit, given those numbers. So those are the suits that I wanted to discuss that have been dropped and are still going forward. I think we're going to see more of this, because there are more outstanding. And after the attorney general is in, we had the hearings for attorney general. Merrick Garland is up. we'll see once he gets in whether or not they're going to take a look at some more. We'll talk to you about it. We'll be back in a little bit.